From the heart of our nation's capital, here's Family Research Council President Tony Perkins. Sitting in today for Tony is our own Sarah Perry, Director of Partnerships for Family Research Council.
Good Thursday afternoon to you. I'm Sarah Perry, your host on this, the 30th day of July, 2020. Coming up on today's edition of Washington Watch, as the dust settles on Capitol Hill and the big tech titans return to their work in Silicon Valley, the impressions in the House and Senate on ways to counter online censorship and monopolization are many. What are the key takeaways and what's a workable solution to countering the outsized influence of online platforms? Craig Parshall, special counsel to the American Center for Law and Justice and founder of a John Milton Project for Digital Free Speech, will join me. In my second block, Brandon Showalter, reporter for the Christian Post, will join me to discuss how the censorious tech giants are particularly concerned with blocking the truth on sexual orientation and gender identity on their platforms. Plus, Harry Potter author J.K. Rowling doubles down on her statements on transgenderism while predicting a coming crisis in the medicalization of minor kids. At the bottom of the hour is the pandemic pushing people towards socialism. One Bloomberg journalist seems to think so, and what do generational differences have to do with it? David Claussen, FRC's Director of Christian Ethics and Biblical Worldview, will join me. And in my last block, liberal pundits are predicting that after the Supreme Court ruling in the Bostock cases, Title IX could be the next federal statute in the crosshairs. In anticipation, some states have passed protective legislation, with Idaho's legislature being the first in the country to enforce the rights of high school and college girls from having to compete alongside biological boys. Although the ACLU was quick to pounce with a lawsuit now pending in federal court, 300 athletes have now issued a letter to the NCAA's Board of Directors urging them to drop the boycott of Idaho sports over the recent bill. Can women's sports be saved? Well, I'll have Doreen Denny, Vice President of Government Relations for Concerned Women for America, with her take. A reminder, our podcast website is tonyperkins.com. Follow us on social media, Twitter at FRCDC or on Facebook. And a reminder for those of you who don't yet have it, make sure you have the Stand Firm app. Download it in your smartphone's app store, and you can take Washington Watch with you wherever you go. Well, big tech has dominated this week's news cycle with reports of additional censorship mounting and two hearings on the Hill, one on the reform of Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act in the Senate on Tuesday, and another on antitrust and market monopolization in the House on Wednesday, where CEOs from the four nation's most powerful companies testified for House lawmakers on Wednesday over bipartisan allegations of unfair market practices. The four companies represented, Facebook, Google, Apple, and Amazon, are worth nearly $5 trillion. Joining me now with this week's takeaways is special counsel to the American Center for Law and Justice, digital free speech expert, and my father, Craig Parshall. Dad, welcome back.
Sarah, that last title is the most important one, and it's always great to be back with you.
Well, it is in my mind anyway, and now we have an audience and a recording to prove it. So we've got two hearings, one in the Senate on Section 230 and one in the House on antitrust. But I talked a little bit with John Schweppe earlier this week, and they seem to be related to different issues, but they have a level of commonality. Can you explain how they're related?
Yes. The House antitrust hearing was scheduled for Monday and then was rescheduled for Wednesday. The Senate hearing specifically was dealing with Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act, which gives an extraordinary grant of immunity from being sued to these tech giants in Silicon Valley with regard to their conduct. Now, at first sight, you think, well, it's apples and oranges, but it really isn't. It's flip sides of the same coin. And the coin has to do with the power and size and scope of each of these Silicon Valley companies. And the ones that, of course, were brought in the dock this week were Sundar Pichai, who is the CEO for Google, Jeff Bezos, who's the owner of Amazon, Mark Zuckerberg, the founder of Facebook, and Tim Cook, who runs Apple. these four companies, Google, Amazon, Facebook, and Apple. The question is, from the standpoint of antitrust in the House hearing, well, are you a monopoly? And if so, are you destroying competition in an unfair, illegal way? And should you be broken up? Should there be a remedy under antitrust law to handle your anti-competitive conduct? And is it harming consumers? And if so, in what way? But the reason that they have become monopolies, and I will tell you that there seems to be a growing bipartisan consensus in both the House and the Senate, that in fact they are monopolies. Google manages more than 90% of the world's search engine activity. Amazon is the world's leader for retail sales and has basically put book publishers, many of them, out of business because it is the leader in terms of online book sales. Facebook is the number one social media site, owning three other companies, and combined it is the biggest leader out of the top six in the world. And then Apple, of course, is so big that for more than a decade, when Apple goes up in the stock market, so does Wall Street. I mean, it has that large a financial impact. So the question is, have you gotten too big, and how are you using your power? Well, the reason they've gotten big, one of the reasons, not just because of their computer engineering brilliance, which is a foregone conclusion, but also Congress gave them this 230 immunity back in 1996 under the Communications Decency Act to be free from almost every lawsuit, which is an extraordinary gift that they've never given to any other company or set of companies or any part of our enterprise system under the free market in the United States. So as a result, they have been free not only to get large, but to be mean-spirited, I would suggest, in the way in which they suppress conservative opinions. Every one of them has, at various times and frequently and consistently, suppressed otherwise lawful conservative opinion and content. So the question really becomes, in both houses, what do we do about it?
Well, and Jim Jordan actually started his line of questioning by saying he was going to cut to the chase. Big tech is out to get conservatives, which I think all of us who are listening to this broadcast probably would agree with. But you're saying that you think possibly this is an increasingly bipartisan issue and not one that's just solely held by the GOP.
Yeah, this is an extraordinary thing, Sarah, as you know, because in this very heated political climate during an election season, there's very little that both parties agree to in Congress. But this is one that they are agreeing on, and that is that there's a problem with these big tech platforms that have become monopolies, have used their monopoly power unfairly. Now, what unfairly means is slightly different from the Democrats and the Republicans. The Democrats are concerned with the fact, as an example, Representative Joe DeGruz, who is the Democrat, indicated, look, to Facebook, in his questioning to Mark Zuckerberg, isn't it true you bought Instagram? And now, of course, Facebook owns and operates Instagram as well as Messenger. And Facebook's CEO and leader and creator said, well, we did buy them. There were many concerns for why, reasons why we bought them. But under increasing questioning, the answer became clear. Facebook bought Instagram because it was a threat in the market. In fact, Mark Zuckerberg had made statements to that effect at one time. And so I think he lost that argument. It was very clear that from a monopolistic standpoint, that is anti-competitive behavior. Buying out everyone who may be a threat to you to increase your largesse in the market and to be a titan, not just a competitor. Now, the Republicans, on the other hand, yes, they're concerned about antitrust, but more importantly, how are you using your power to hurt consumers in terms of their free expression values? Are you picking and choosing winners? In fact, it's gone beyond just conservatives, Sarah. As you know, Google on YouTube and Facebook, as well as Instagram, owned by Facebook, have all suppressed a conference this week of medical doctors talking about alternative therapies for COVID-19 that were politically incorrect in the view of all those Silicon Valley companies. So they were suppressed. They were taken off the platform.
So Section 230, we've just explained, this is shielded these platforms from legal immunity for many years. It's this unforeseen benefit that has outpaced anything else available in the free market economy. There are some people who are saying, you know, listen, these antitrust hearings are no big deal. And then there were others who were saying getting the four tech titan CEOs in front of Congress is sort of a big tobacco moment. This is a big deal. So where do you come down on really what the import is of this?
Yeah, that's a good example, because as we know, there were consequences from that lineup of big tobacco companies, all with their hands raised, all saying, I swear that, and those became famous words, and state attorney generals came in after them. Likewise, state attorney generals across the country are now mounting their own antitrust investigations under state law against those same Silicon Valley players, Amazon, Google, Facebook, and Apple, and to some degree, Twitter. By the way, Twitter, although it wasn't lined up, they were mentioned, Jim Jordan said, look, I've been shadow banned by Twitter several times. Well, yeah. What that means, basically, is that you're shut down, but you don't know it. So you think your tweets are still going out, but in fact, nobody's receiving them.
Right.
Last night, I in a meeting with a senator, I was given first-hand information that a book that the senator had authored had been suppressed when that's a member of that senator's family tried to blog about it and post about it because wow. It was supposedly political, because it was written by a senator having nothing to do with politics. So this is the power over viewpoint and content that these tech companies come from. And unfortunately, we all know where they are politically and in terms of their social values. Mark Zuckerberg, when he was in Congress the very first time, some time ago, was blatantly not only open about it, but he was also correct. He said Silicon Valley is extremely left-leaning.
Left-wing, absolutely.
Yeah.
Now,
and
listen,
that's going to change there, even if we break them up.
So we got about a minute left here, but I know that you've had some of these meetings on Capitol Hill talking about a possible solution. These are complex issues. How close are we to something that's workable here?
I think we have to be close. And the reason I think we have to be close is when a high-ranking executive of Google says, we're not going to allow 2016, meaning the Trump victory on the national election, we're not going to allow that to happen again. We're not going to. Google is the number one search engine for what's going on. Google News is accessed constantly by millions of people every day, mm-hmm. every minute. And people who want to find out what's happening in the election cycle and what politicians stand for go to Google. And Google rigs the results. And that is the power they have. And I think the time is now for some statutory change, not an eradication of Section 230, but some statutory change to give consumers, you and I, and American citizens, a voice.
Craig Parshall, special counsel to the American Center for Law and Justice, founder of the John Milton Project for Free Speech. We'll be waiting to see what happens. The time is right for some intervention, not an elimination, but we'll see exactly what protections the future holds for us. Coming up, we'll talk about how J.K. Rowling is continuing to push back against the transgender ideology with Christian Post reporter Brandon Showalter right after this on Washington Watch. Stick around. We'll be right back.
Masculinity in America has never been under attack the way it is today. We've reached the point where the term itself is considered toxic or offensive to many. The consistent message in our nation is that masculinity by nature is bad and is the root cause of many of the problems plaguing our society. From his experience as a military combat officer and ordained minister of the gospel, Lieutenant General William Boykin has seen and dealt with firsthand the breakdown of leadership in our nation by the lack of godly men living lives of biblical purpose. In his latest book, Man to Man, Rediscovering Masculinity in a Challenging World, he addresses the essential elements of manhood as a provider, an instructor, a defender, a battle buddy, and a chaplain, and explains how to personally develop these traits and pass them to the next generation. Get your copy today of Man to Man wherever books are sold.
Absent fathers, distracted fathers, and angry fathers have created a vacuum of the soul in the lives of many children. Pornography is epidemic, affecting the male brain, isolating his heart, and degrading women who long to be cherished. Confusion and even skepticism about marriage run rampant, especially in our younger generations. Selfishness among men has led to broken homes and a trail littered with broken hearts, including their own. Where can you turn to find the solutions to these problems? Leadership and Love, A Tale of Two Fathers, is a new publication from Family Research Council that takes a look at two men, Joshua and the father of the prodigal son, as strong examples of leadership and love. It also weaves in an understanding of attachment science to underscore the needs of children, which need to be met to become emotionally healthy and spiritually strong. Visit frc.org/fathers to learn more.
In today's culture, it can be difficult for men to navigate what it means to be a man and to find clear models of masculinity and manhood. There are many competing ideas out there and even confusion around the basic concepts of gender and sex. Where can boys, young men, husbands, and fathers find a model of manhood, leadership, and strength in today's culture of confusion? This is Tony Perkins inviting you to join me at a Stand Courageous Men's Conference led by men who are seasoned, compassionate leaders who understand the issues of the day. These issues will invest in unpacking our role as defenders, providers, instructors, and battle buddies so that men can have generational influence as a chaplain inside and outside the home. Join us at one of our upcoming events in Texas, Louisiana, Florida, or Virginia. Learn more about Stand Courageous and find an event near you at StandCourageous.com. That's StandCourageous.com. StandCourageous.com.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. I am Sarah Perry, sitting in for Tony Perkins on this Thursday afternoon. We've just been talking tech censorship. It's been a big week on Capitol Hill, and there seems to be no greater format for censorship. Nothing that hits the censor tripwires quite like discussions of sexual orientation and gender identity. That's a quick way to get yourself deplatformed. My guest knows something about it. Brandon Showalter is a reporter for the Christian Post and has been covering these issues. He joins me now to talk about it. Brandon, welcome back.
Thank you, Sarah. Good to be with you.
Well, I want to talk first about Facebook, because recently you talked to an individual who runs a ministry called Restored Hope Network. What happened to her on Facebook?
Well, I spoke with Ann Polk, and yes, you know, screenshots from their latest conference where, you know, individuals who once identified as among the LGBT were sharing their stories and their testimonies, talking about how relational problems have relational solutions. But that is, you know, that's verboten. You're not allowed to say those kinds of things or in any way scrutinize the alphabet soup of all this gender stuff these days. Former transgender identified persons and some who once identified as lesbian or gay. Yes, because of the, you know, I guess the standard that Facebook has adopted about not promoting quote unquote conversion therapy, which really is a scare term, those things are being taken down. And so I'm aware of a few ministries, not just RHN, that are doing their due diligence to gather all their contexts so that if indeed their pages are taken down, they have another way to connect.
Well, nobody knows the sort of tech giant's wrath like J.K. Rowling does, and she's become sort of an unlikely hero of the pro-science, anti-gender identity movement. She actually has emerged, and I think when you have that much influence, that much popularity, and that much money, you can continue to say whatever you want, and good on her. Yeah. We have found sort of an unlikely masthead in all of this, but she's actually recently come to say that not only has she adhered to her previous statements, but she is now anticipating, she's predicting an ongoing upcoming medical crisis on gender identity procedures for kids. Talk a little bit about that.
Well, I absolutely think that her messaging is brilliant. She was speaking about some studies that have come out from, I believe, Marcus Evans, who's been scrutinizing what's been going on at the Tavistock Clinic in London with regard to transgender medical treatments that are very experimental, and the whole puberty blockers and cross-sex hormones and all that kind of thing, based on very, very flimsy evidence. And she was predicting that there is indeed a medical scandal that will erupt soon, and we're going to realize how many of these children were put on this pathway where their bodies have been permanently ruined, sterilized, and mutilated. And I've spoken with other, even you know, lesbian attorneys and, you know, radical feminists and gay men who are very much opposed to this. And what I've heard some of them say, and I agree with it, is that until all of this is framed in public discourse as a medical scandal, there's not going to be any pushback. But J.K. Rowling is now framing it as such. And so, like you, I say good on her.
Yes, yes, absolutely. And, you know, may England be a harbinger of the common sense to come in America,
yes.
Because we know that the
yes.
UK Trade Minister, Liz Truss, announced earlier this year that restrictions on medical practices would be established as concerns minors and gender identity medical treatments, which is wonderful to have somebody at that level of a governmental administration say, we are going to lock down what you are able to do. These children can't contract or get their ears pierced without a parental
right.
involvement figure. And here what we're doing is we are essentially sending them like lambs to the slaughter, and they are
Absolutely.
Responsive. Mm-hmm. As you know, having talked to Abigail Schreier as well, we send
yeah.
them like lambs thinking, okay, well, naturally, we trust them to make their own decisions. Why can't they, of course, advocate for their own health care? But that's an opportunity that's rife for predatory behavior. And that's what you're seeing.
Absolutely. Well, and I frankly, I can't believe that I have to come on the radio in 2020 and say that it's not ethical to,
yes.
you know, slice off children's breasts and genitals.
Right.
Can we please not do that?
I mean, yes.
Literally, our children are being devoured and sliced up. And I hear from parents who... The suffering is just exponential that happens in these families when their children, and despite a near total mass media blackout, the detransitioners, those who have undergone these treatments, like, you know, Tavistock, there's a lawsuit going on against the clinic now, where it's a 16-year-old girl, she was transitioned and now she's 23, and she realizes how wrong it was, how she was steered down this pathway. Well, there's
right.
more of those making noise here in the United States and in Canada, and they realize it was all a mistake. What are we going to tell them? Why did we allow this to happen?
Right.
I mean, it's just brutal. It's just brutal what they've been through, and so we need to hear their stories more.
Brandon, my last question to you, because we've only got a few minutes left here. What do you attribute our difficulty in speaking these messages to here in America? Now, understandably, those who are the dissenters in the notion of gender identity and its attendant illnesses in England have also had to push back, as it's evidenced by J.K. Rowling. They've also had their own fight. Is it simply the bulk of gender clinics? Is it popular notion? Why do we appear to be having to fight so much harder than our friends across the pond?
It's a really good question. I do know that one of the things is that I think people have failed to understand the amount of money that is behind this movement. There's a lot of money to be made within big medicine and big pharma, because once you go on these controversial experimental drugs, these puberty blockers and hormones, you're going to be a medical patient for life. And so it behooves us to start asking why are so many state agencies deconstructing sex? Why are they trying to rewrite all these laws? It's like, well, there are people that stand to benefit from it. And
yes.
while, you know, you can scrutinize what kind of healthcare system you think is better, whether you like the British, you know, NHS and a nationalized healthcare, or our system, which is much more privatized, there's just not as much scrutiny that goes on here because there's less, you know, the money is a big factor. But there are many, many reasons. But I just say any journalist or anybody who wants to speak out about this, do it as much as you can, because most of the purportedly mainstream media is in the tank for this. And it's going to be people who are brave and truth tellers, independent media, other journalists like myself and anybody else, to just tell the truth however they can and get the information out there, because, you know, the truth at the end of the day, it stands alone.
Brandon, I'm so glad you came on today. Brandon Showalter, check out his writing at ChristianPost.com. He's been covering gender identity for a while. Coming up next, how do we biblically respond to the notion that the pandemic is increasing socialists? I've got David Clausen, FRC's Director of Christian Ethics and Biblical Worldview, next.
Do Christians have a biblical obligation to participate in government? Do Christians have a duty to vote? And if so, what principles should inform them while casting their ballots? How should pastors think about politics, and how can they shepherd their congregations well during an election season? The gospel of Jesus Christ has implications for all areas of our life, including politics. Christians must be prepared to grapple with the moral issues of our day, the reality of our two-party system, and follow our Christian convictions to their logical end by voting for candidates that support clear biblical values. Family Research Council has partnered with 21 state family policy councils for a new edition of Biblical Principles for Political Engagement. This booklet provides biblical wisdom and clear answers to pivotal questions to help you navigate the political landscape. This publication exists to facilitate careful thinking about issues and encourage God-honoring political engagement that filters all issues and candidates through a biblical worldview. To read the full publication, visit frc.org/engage.
Not so long ago, sex education in public schools involved learning about human growth and development and listening to advice on how to be careful, respect others, and save sex for marriage. Things are very different today. Parents have two main concerns about sex ed: that it sexualizes children and that it's loaded with LGBTQ indoctrination. Family Research Council has released a new resource to address this issue titled Sex Education in Public Schools: Sexualization of Children and LGBT Indoctrination. This resource reveals troubling examples of the agenda-driven content being pushed in modern sex ed and exposes the powerful organizations behind it all. Finally, it offers some action steps for parents to consider in their fight to protect the health and innocence of their children. For more information about sex education in public schools and to view this resource, visit frc.org/sexeducation. That's frc.org/sexeducation.
To Washington Watch. It is Thursday, the 30th of July. Can you believe the month is almost out? I am Sarah Perry, sitting in with you this afternoon. And according to a recent Bloomberg journalist, everything about COVID-19 seems unfair. Perhaps you agree. It affects the worst poor as it does the rich, those who have a nest egg. Those who are poor seem to be affected worse. They lose jobs. They suffer pay cuts. Blacks seem to be more affected than whites. We know that the science is still being parsed out about why particularly their physiologies are more affected. It disrupts the lives of people in some generations more than others. The elderly are more affected than the young. But this is basically social and political dynamite. So you combine the haves and the have-nots, the generations one to another, blacks to whites, and treat them all with the same very unfair paintbrush of the COVID-19 pandemic. And well, you have not only political dynamite, you have rather an ethical crisis on your hands, which is why I wanted to talk to our David Clausen, who is FRC's Director of Christian Ethics and Biblical Worldview. So, David, welcome back.
Hey, great to be back on the show with you, Sarah.
So COVID-19 sort of puts a magnifying glass on differences, disparities, and inequities. In your mind, do you think that's sort of sufficient cannon fodder to make a number of sort of future developing socialists?
Well, I certainly hope not. It's interesting, this article that came out in Bloomberg essentially has said that this pandemic is, you know, creating a whole generation of socialists. And, you know, I think that might be painting with too broad of a brush. However, I think it was a helpful article. You know, I think I am a millennial. I was born in 1991. And, let's be honest, the pandemic has been hard on everyone. And I think all of us have been affected in some way. And, you know, none of our lives are the same as they were, you know, at the beginning of this. And for many people in my age range, millennials in their, 20s and 30s, it has been especially difficult. And I think this article does capture some of the frustration and angst that people in this younger demographic are experiencing.
Yeah.
I think maybe there are some who are, being tempted into thinking socialism maybe is the answer for the economic and political woes that we're experiencing. But obviously, as a Christian, as a conservative, and as just as a thinking American, I don't think that's the right way to go.
Right, right. Listen, we know that socialism is ultimately totalitarianism. In fact, I believe it was Lenin, though I'm sure someone will fact check me, who said that communism is where old socialists go to die. This is what we're looking at. The true socialist model for governance is an autocratic one. It's totalitarian. So it's not something we want to see in a nation founded on the precepts of liberty and individual freedom and natural law. So it's discouraging to read things like we do in Bloomberg, in that the pandemic is driving more socialists because it affects everyone so unequally, and some people are really taking the brunt. Which brings me to another question, David. How do we as Christians approach the notion of unfair circumstances when we feel as though we've done everything right and the outcome is not only beyond our control, it hits us as being just patently unfair? Where do we find hope in that as Christians?
Well, you know, that's a good question, Sarah. And I think, you know, as Christians, we do have the categories to think through that, because we live in a Genesis 3 world, like I like to say. You know, we live in a fallen world where sin has run amok. It's disordered affections. It's disordered the way we think about things. And it has affected institutions. It's affected governments. And so, you know, in this life, there are things that are not going to be fair. And I think as Christians, we have the categories to realize that is the result of living in a fallen world. But when it comes to economics, you know, we know socialism is not the way to go. Paul talks about that in 2 Thessalonians. If anyone is not willing to work, let him not eat. We know from Colossians 3 that all of us should work hard as Christians, working unto the Lord. But yes. Broadly speaking, Sarah, I think all of us need to realize that as Christians, this world's not going to be fair, but ultimately God is sovereign, and we need to realize everything we do needs to be done for Him and for His honor and for His glory. And ultimately, that's, as Christians, how we need to orient our lives.
I think there has to be something said also about how we can elevate our fellow millennials and Gen Yers out of a sense that they've somehow been robbed. And a lot of that was addressed in this article, in that the boomers have it better than the millennials. And I could argue a completely different perspective and say that the millennials and the Generation Yers have had things easier for them. They've had more career opportunities. They were provided with more security and safety. My generation, the Gen Xers, we were largely helicopter parents. We protected them from consequences of the world, and I think in so doing may have done them a disservice. I am married to a free-range parent. I was more of a helicopter parent. I had to fight that. But I think what we're seeing now is we're seeing the fruits of all of that parenting labor and how the Lord responds to us as truly a free-range parent and gives us the opportunity to make biblically sound choices because He loves us.
Yeah, that's well said.
David Clausen.
We need to always push against this sense of entitlement. So you're well said, Sarah.
David Clausen is our Director of Christian Ethics and Biblical Worldview. We have a number of publications of his at our website, frc.org. Well, coming up, we'll talk about the Title IX statute in a post-Bostock age, Concerned Women for America's work to protect Title IX and the Idaho Women's Sports Bill, and what gender identity now looks like in federal law, with Vice President of Government Relations for Concerned Women for America, Doreen Denny, right after this on Washington Watch. Could you use some timely and original commentary to read this summer, specifically on the issues facing our culture today? FRCblog.com has just what you're looking for. The content on our blog is written by our policy experts, members of the Family Research Council team, as well as outside contributors. You can learn about religious liberty, life, marriage, family, sexuality, public policy, and the culture. Check out this list of a few of our most recent titles. What Does It Mean to Be a Woman? DC Christians Take to the Streets to Sing, Lament, and Pray, and Prayerfully Responding to Civil Unrest. at Family Research Council. Our mission is to advance faith, family, and freedom in the culture by helping you to live out your faith and stand for truth. Our blog helps you do just that. Stay informed and get the resources you need at frcblog.com. On April 16th, President Trump and the White House Coronavirus Task Force announced a three-phase plan with guidelines for how states can begin scaling back restrictions. Churches should begin putting in place plans to reopen and operate their ministries according to the guidance of the Centers for Disease Control as state officials begin lifting orders. Here at Family Research Council, we have summarized the White House three-phase plan and how it relates to in-person church meetings and gatherings. Check out our resource, What Pastors Should Know About the White House Plan to Open Up America Again. Our resource offers practical guidelines for how churches and houses of worship can begin to operate safely as our country reopens. Visit frc.org/church guidelines to view this resource and learn more. There, you'll also find our full list of resources for churches in the time of coronavirus. Again, that's frc.org/church guidelines.
Hey, Matt.
Hey, Hannah.
What's going on? Why so gloomy?
Well, I'm a little disappointed. I had a lot planned to do during the stay-at-home time, and I just didn't do it.
Oh, yeah? What did you have planned that you didn't get to do?
Well, I was actually hoping I would finally be able to get time to do a regular Bible reading routine, and I started a couple of times. I just didn't stick with it.
Don't be too down on yourself. Starting a new routine can be hard, but one way to help is to join in with others and to have a good game plan. I think I have a good solution for you.
Oh, yeah?
Tony Perkins and FRC are doing a 2-year study in the Word. They have it all mapped out.
When did they start? I would be so far behind.
Oh, that's not a problem. You can literally jump in anytime. There's a daily reading, just a couple of chapters a day, with questions to help you think about what you're reading.
Nice. Where can I find this?
Go to frc.org/Bible, and you can get started.
Where's that again?
frc.org/Bible.
Got it. Checking it out now.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. It is Thursday, July 30th, and I'm Sarah Perry sitting in with you this afternoon. Well, on March 18th, the Fairness in Women's Sports Act, known as House Bill 500, passed the Idaho State Legislature, and shortly thereafter, Governor Brad Little signed the historic bill into law. It's the first in the country, ensures that women and girls have a level playing field when competing in athletics. Not surprisingly, the ACLU was quick off the blocks. They sued on behalf of a transgender athlete, and the matter now rests with U.S. District Judge David Nye. He has said he will decide on the matters of an injunction or a dismissal of the case by August 10th, which is the date on which fall sports in Idaho begin. Now, my next guest is on the front lines protecting girls and young women in interscholastic athletics. I have had the pleasure of working with her, and she is tremendous. It's Doreen Denny, Vice President of Government Relations for Concerned Women for America. Doreen, welcome back.
Well, thank you so much, Sari. It's a pleasure to be with you.
So I think we have to start with the elephant in the room, which is Title IX and interscholastic athletics for young girls and young women now appears to be in a bit of the liberal crosshairs post-Bostock. And I find myself worrying, as I'm sure most of the conservative or rational thinking people in the world do, that this is now the next federal statute to fall. Do you feel the same way?
Well, I think we feel that the ground is shaking, and we need to be very vigilant to ensure that the decision that was reached by the court in Bostock is not extended in a way that it was never intended. Let's not forget that there was disagreement in that result Title VII and the employment law, that Congress has never legislated this way, and the court was basically acting in its own right to be legislators instead of judges. And so that's the first issue. But the second issue is just the concern that we would have that like often happens, that decisions get then extrapolated, and Title IX would be one of the very first ones to be at risk. And it's stated as such even in Justice Alito's dissent. yes. as one among many implications or potential consequences if we're not vigilant.
Now, we do know that we have an administration that takes very seriously this notion of textualism and taking the word of the law as it is passed at the time, not out of context, not infusing meaning or desired political outcome. In fact, Department of Justice argued when Bostock was before the Supreme Court that when Title VII was enacted in 1964, sex meant biological sex, naturally, the physiological distinction between male and female. In fact, the Department of Education, when they adjudicated, when they determined through the Office of Civil Rights that Selena Sewell, who is the track athlete who has brought suit against the Connecticut Interscholastic Athletic Association, when they reviewed her claim after a very long 8 months, not a flippant decision, they did find discrimination in her case on the status of being a biological girl. The Department of Justice filed a statement of interest in Selena Sewell's case as well. So we know that the government, the administration, is mm-hmm. taking very seriously this notion of making sure that biological women are protected. So you actually, together in conjunction with Save Women's Sports, and we've had their founder, Beth Steltzer, on the radio with us, talk a little mm-hmm. bit about the letter that you've advanced that a number of athletes have signed on.
Yeah, well, and it's very important to recognize that the biological distinctions of sex and the capacity for a person who would want to identify as the opposite sex from being a male to being a woman, those inherent differences don't just go away. Those physiological yes. advantages do stay, and research is proving that. You know, there have been studies that have done that, but unfortunately, the NCAA has kind of gone along the same track as the International Olympic Committee in declaring that if a biological male athlete takes a year of hormone treatments, then that athlete could then go into the women's category and right. compete against women. And because that's been happening, and it's had real effects. I mean, there have been national titles that have been won. It was really important that the basis for Idaho's law became the law of the state. And so yes. Idaho decided, you know, with this threat, we're going to pass this law. Well, you can imagine that the ACLU got right on it and asked the NCAA to boycott Idaho. And right. because of that, we felt it was very important to provide the alternative voice here and say, excuse me, we don't need activism against Idaho for doing something as basic as standing up for female athletes, that female athletics are for women and for biological women, and that's the way that it should be. And so over 300 female athletes, they were NCAA current or former athletes or professional athletes, some of them have been Olympians, signed this letter that was sent to the Board of Governors. You know, they were willing to have their name and, you know, public to the extent that it went to the NCAA, but we haven't made those names public. Some of them have come out publicly. But that's a very strong statement to the NCAA, asking them not to act in retaliation against Idaho for doing something that they felt was important, which was stand up for female athletes.
Yes, and the fact that there were 300 of them is so impressive. In fact, you mentioned the International Olympic Committee as well. Just for those who are listening, SaveWomensSports.com is continuing to run an active petition to the International Olympic Board. And in a certain respect, we sort of got a stay of execution on this because they had originally determined that they were going to permit biological males to compete alongside biological females. So there's a petition that's currently running there at SaveWomensSports.com. But for a copy of the letter that's also gone out to the NCAA Board of Governors, visit ConcernedWomen.org, where you can find a copy of that letter. Doreen, you've been writing very exclusively and extensively on this notion of gender identity. You had an op-ed last December in the Washington Times about how Trump can save women's sports. Now that you look back, did you find that an accurately predictive article? Has he done through this administration what you had hoped he would do?
Well, he's taken some really positive steps, and we saw that with both of the Department of Justice statements of interest in these critical cases, one in Connecticut, which and one in Idaho. Those are still ongoing. I mean, the legal challenges mm-hmm. are still underway. And then making the decision in the complaint, which was a civil rights complaint from the Department of Education in Selena Sewell's case with the Connecticut track athletes, that was also significant, ruling in their favor. We still have some outstanding business, however. We've actually
yes.
filed two complaints at the college level and feel that
yes.
and,
talk
and
about
it's
those.
All very related to these. Yes, one is against Franklin Pierce University for the athlete for the situation in which an athlete won the NCAA title in 2019 in women's hurdles, and the other is the case in University of Montana athlete that won the Big Sky Conference championship in February in the indoor mile. Now, two of the athletes that have had to run against and compete against the Big Sky Conference in the Big Sky Conference, University of Montana. Two of them are from Idaho and are now defendants of the Idaho law, and so they are part of this challenge. And we're grateful because they're the front line. They're the real victims here.
Yes,
and it's important. You know, organizations like ours, we can provide voice and provide mechanisms for trying to get the government to act, for recognizing and supporting the legal challenges. But it's the athletes that are on the front lines, who are the really ones feeling and experiencing the realities of being sidelined in sports this way. And it's not fair. And in fact, one of the athletes, the Olympians that signed this letter, it's a pretty big name in the books. Her name's Donna DeVerona. She was one of the pioneers of Title IX, and then also an Olympian. She was a world-class marathon in the category of swimming. And it's just important to remember that these people that have paved the way for us, they fought long and hard for women athletes to have a place on the playing field where sports were dedicated to our competition.
Yeah.
And that's what we have to preserve. Because if we can have a situation that just allows for any male athletes that are identifying as women or want to or think that they've got a better shot at it to be able to do that, you know, we're not going to have women's athletics anymore. We might have
no.
mixed sports. We might have, you know, non-gendered or, you know, sports, mixed categories, but we're not going to have female athletics. And that's what we're trying to preserve here.
And it's interesting, you and I have talked about this. This comes up repeatedly because I think there is this sort of notion that if we say it, or at least for me, if I just keep explaining the fact that we are losing 50 years of progress as women and everything that we've fought for, that naturally people will go, oh, it's common sense. Well, naturally, we don't want to take away these legislative protections. And yet, you can still elicit the fervor of the Twitter mob should you say something like J.K. Rowling does, which is just that men are men and women are women. So we've talked also this week about some recent polling out of 10 battleground states. And our friend Jennifer Bryson wrote about this recently at American Greatness. There were 10 battleground states. These are all states that Trump needs to win for re-election. 75% of respondents, registered voters, said no to males in female sports. Now, did this surprise you that in these swing states, which are generally a mix, if you're talking about the electorate, these are generally a mix of individuals who have a variety of perspectives, 75% of them said, get biological men out of women's sports?
Well, I saw those polls, and I was surprised and astounded and frankly very gratified to see that, because ones that I'd seen previously, maybe on a national scale, maybe not state by state, had maybe been, you know, more people had been undecided on this issue. And so you maybe had 60% say that, and a lot of people just not sure, actually around 20%. They didn't know how to think about that. I think
yeah.
that we've made some progress in recognizing it because of what's happening. And I think it's so common sense and basic for people that they're kind of wondering why this is, why are we even having this discussion?
Right.
But the reality is it is real. This is not a hypothetical question of will the Bostock decision now apply to Title IX and displace women? No, this is already happening. This
right.
happened because the Obama administration put this into place. Schools, because of the NCAA's policy, schools are basically forced to have to, you know, at the college level, to have to maybe accept an individual in that in a transgender category, you know, category into female sports. It's wrong. It shouldn't be happening.
Right.
And I was really grateful that Senator Lee in a hearing just last week, the NCAA president, Mark Emmert, was before the committee to talk about protecting the integrity of,
yes,
of college sports. Dealt with the college at the compensation issue, but he asked Mark Emmert whether or not he thought, stood by the NCAA's statement that Idaho law was going to be harmful and they were going to take it up, you know, that it's not a good law. And he said he stood by that. And, you know, that's just a slap in the face for
it
female
is.
Athletes. And honestly, if there are people listening today feel strongly about this, please send letters to the NCAA. Please,
yes,
send letters to Mark Emmert and the president. Tell them it's not right and that they should back off and that they should support female athletes. We need to make sure that our daughters today don't see the future for them as being something that's discouraging and basically they don't have a shot. And that's what's happened. And unfortunately, you know, it's happened in for athletes at the high school level that they weren't able to thrive and flourish to the extent that they would have liked to. They were disadvantaged at that place, and it's happening at the college level as well. And we'll,
absolutely,
see it in the Olympics next summer if there isn't a change. And so I really appreciate, Sarah, that you've taken time to discuss this today, because it's something that really needs to be, we're aware of, and I'm grateful that the voters in those swing states see this as being an important issue and something that they would that they're on the right side of the issue.
You know, it's interesting because you talked about really how discouraging it is, and Selena Sewell has said as much. She said basically it's debilitating when you get to the starting block and you look over and you see two biological boys running with you. Regardless of how much testosterone suppression they take, you can never make up for bone density, lung capacity, muscle mass, innate speed. And we know that the New Zealand scholars who came out a few months ago in the Journal of Medical Ethics, not surprisingly, the science supported precisely what we've been saying from the beginning, which is that,
right,
biological males possess physiological and therefore performative advantages over biological women in sports. All of this effort to make sure that our participation and our daughters' and granddaughters' participation is protected, only to be torn apart by the culture mob that suddenly decides that the word sex no longer means what it has always meant. And unfortunately, the Supreme Court was an unfortunate harbinger and an interpreter, I believe, the wrong way. I have some words with Justice Gorsuch, if I ever get him privately. That being said, I do believe this is something that we need to continue to fight for. SaveWomensSports.org is where the petition is running to the International Olympic Committee. And for a copy of the NCAA letter, go to ConcernedWomen.org, where you can find that letter. You can see what was said, what these 300 athletes were willing to commit themselves to. Use that as a fundamental block as you reach out to the NCAA, because before we know it, these are our girls or our granddaughters on the starting block. We don't want them to be debilitated and discouraged by this. Doreen, thanks for all the good work you do at CWA. This has been Washington Watch on the Thursday edition. It's been my pleasure to be with you, and make sure that you tune in tomorrow for Friday's edition. We'll see you then.
Washington Watch with Tony Perkins is brought to you by Family Research Council and is entirely listener-supported. Portions of the show discussing candidates are brought to you by Family Research Council Action. For more information on anything you've heard today, or to find out how you can partner with us in our ongoing efforts to promote faith, family, and freedom, visit TonyPerkins.com. Also, to leave a comment about Washington Watch, call our watch line at 1-866-372-7234. That's 1-866-372-7234.